right, all right. Damn, that's exactly what I need to wake up, okay? Even though it's, oh, I don't know, is it like 9 o'clock at night? Or is it noontime? Yeah, or is it 10 o'clock in the morning? There you go. All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We have a packed show, and I'm going to run through the lineup real quick. At the back end of the show, you're going to be hearing some voices from July 15th, the nationwide protests in 19 cities demanding the Trump-Pence regime must go. All right, that's, and we're going to try and bring some of that stuff to you over the next few weeks, each week, and see what we can do with that, all right? And before that, you'll be listening to an interview I did with Sivia Tamarkin, and she's the director, writer, and executive producer of a film called Birthright, A War Story, a feature-length documentary that examines how women are being jailed, physically violated, and even put at risk of dying as a vicious anti-woman movement tightens its grip across America. This is, I was really, really glad to be doing this interview. But opening the show up, I'm really, really happy to be bringing back to the show Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And he is in Chicago for the Revolution Summer, and we're talking with him on a regular basis about that. And Carl, how are you? Welcome to the show.
I'm doing fine, Michael, and thank you for having me on.
Yeah, definitely, man. Let's start out with a quick refresher for people. What is going on? What are the RevComs doing in Chicago, the Revolution Club? What's it doing in Chicago? What's going on there? Different aspects of it, just to bring people up to speed on this.
Well, what's going on is that the Revolution Club has initiated what we call a Revolution Summer Project. The club has declared that this summer in Chicago, a city that is known for black and brown people killing each other in horrific numbers, and those killings escalate in the summer. Well, the Revolution Club has declared that this summer will not be a summer of an escalating bloodbath with black and brown people killing each other. It will not be a summer with the cops having free rein to terrorize and murder people in black and brown communities, and that instead this will be a summer of organizing people into an actual revolution that can end all of the horrors that humanity suffers, including the horror of black people and brown people killing each other because of the conditions that the system brings down on them. So that's what we've been doing. We've been going into neighborhoods throughout the South Side of Chicago with this message and connecting people up, mobilizing people to stand up against police terror and calling on people to get out of fighting and killing each other and get into the revolution.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's the response been from people when you walk into a situation like what's happening in Chicago right now?
Well, the response has been varied and rich. From one end, there have been people who have welcomed this message, been attracted to it, and then had a lot of questions. Questions about, well, what is this revolution? Could it really happen? Who's going to lead this revolution? And wait a minute, you guys don't believe in God? And things like that have all come up in relation to that. There have been other people who are like, look, we got it bad enough already. If we get connected with something that's talking about revolution, it's going to be even more heat coming down on us. There's been a few people who embrace the system in its ugliest manifestations. I mean, we've even encountered a few Donald Trump supporters on the South Side of Chicago. And then you have the police, who know they don't want this message getting out and connecting with people, because they would rather have people fighting and killing each other than getting connected with the revolution to deal with that and standing up against the terror that the police are bringing down. And in fact, right now, there is an intense and intensifying face-off going on in a particular South Side neighborhood in the Inglewood district over this message, connecting with people in that neighborhood, and the police coming in to try to stop that.
Can you describe that a little for us?
Well, let me just break it down, because we did a rally in that neighborhood on June 10th to kind of kick off Revolution Summer and put that message out, you know, that, look, it's the system that's responsible for putting you in the conditions where you're fighting and killing each other. And this is no good. It's not in the interest of the people. You got to stop it. You got to get out of it. And you got to get into the revolution. And then we brought to them, I mean, I ran the quote from Bob Avakian down of, look, those of you that the system has cast out that it treats as less than nothing can be the backbone and driving force of a revolution to emancipate humanity, but you can't do it like you are. You got to not only get out of fighting and killing each other, you got to get out of the system's way of thinking that has you caught up in fighting for crumbs that fall off the master's table and telling people how they could start doing that right away. And when we did this rally, there was interest in it and there were questions about it. Then we came back into the neighborhood with a way that people could stand up, because some of the people who were interested in it told us one thing that they really were bothered by was the way the police arbitrarily harassed people, repressed people, brutalized people, and worse. The Revolution Club came back into the neighborhood with whistles that it distributed to people and said, these whistles ain't just for fun. These whistles are to alert the community when the police are in here messing with people, so that people could come out and it could become a collective effort to deal with that, as opposed to one or a couple people being caught up by the police and sweated and brutalized and all like that. And the police literally hated that and came back at people and, look, began to enforce what were nothing more than modern-day black codes. And for those in the audience who may not know what I'm talking about, the black codes were the laws back in slavery days that were used by the slave masters to keep black people down. Laws that said things like black people could not be taught to read and write, that more than two black people gathering anywhere was illegal, and that a black person who was found not on the plantation had to have permission from the slave masters to be out there, and laws like that. Well, the police on this South Side neighborhood in Chicago are enforcing modern-day versions of that. They have approached people and said, you can't be on the street between 7 a.m. and 3 p.m. And if you are caught on the street then, we're going to run you in. They've gone up to people and just harassed them arbitrarily. They have stopped people, handcuffed them, including at times handcuffing as many as six people who were walking in different directions, going about their business, holding them and then letting them go. And they've also told people straight up, don't associate with the revolutionaries. If we catch you talking with them, if we catch you taking their whistles and blowing them, and if we see you putting on that T-shirt, because the uniform of the Revolution Club includes the T-shirt, BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less. And some of the youth, young people in the neighborhood, and older people too, had started buying the T-shirts and started wearing them. And the cops were saying, we catch you wearing that shirt, then you're going to be in trouble. And these are nothing but modern-day black codes, which underscore the reality that while the forms of the suppression of black people in this country have changed, the reality of the continuing suppression of black people is still in effect. And these pigs were out there enforcing it and bringing it down. So what the Revolution Club decided is that we have to go back at that. We can't back off. We can't say, okay, we've done our work in this neighborhood and go somewhere else. And we went back into the neighborhood and told people that we were going to hold a rally right in the middle of these curfew hours from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m., which actually underscores the just arbitrary nature of this stuff, because there's absolutely no good reason to tell people they can't be out on the street between 7 a.m. and 3 p.m. except to deliver to them a message that you're in charge and you can do any doggone thing you want to them and there's nothing they can do about it. Only we are bringing to people that there is something we can do about it. We call this rally for noon, and 10 pig cars came into the area just before noon and arrested the people from the Revolution Club, figuring, well, here's what happens when you stand up to us. And what we did in response to that is we went to the police station, we held a press conference announcing that we were going to do a rally the following day right at the scene of those arrests, which we did. But one interesting thing that happened is that the district commander for that police region came to our press conference to argue with us that we shouldn't be out there, that we were tearing down all the good work that his police were doing in that neighborhood. And this is interesting because he also came to the rally the following day. And we held that rally the following day, right at the spot where they had arrested people for the crime of having put up a sign, posted up a sign in the neighborhood, and resisting arrest, which is what they charge you with when they arrest you and brutalize you and throw you around. And we did this rally. Also present at the rally was a local religious figure, Bishop Greg Greer, and a survivor of torture by the Chicago Police Department, Mark Clements, who had been tortured into giving a false confession in the John Burge torture chambers from back in the 1980s and 1990s. And it really divided things up in the neighborhood because despite all of this stuff the police had been putting down about stay away from the revolutionaries, a bunch of people came to the rally. At the start of the rally, five or six of them put on the Revolution Nothing Less t-shirt. And then there were clumps of people who were not at the rally, but close enough to hear the rally, you know, sitting on benches in the park, standing across the street in front of the deli, in the shade, a distance away. And then as the rally went on, more of them came over. And then when the police commander came right at the end of the rally to tell us that we shouldn't be there, and we were the antithesis of everything that his police were doing, I felt like, okay, I'm finished speaking. Our rally's over. I should go over and tell this pig to stop blinking. And he and I got into a very sharp back and forth because, frankly, he's right. We are the antithesis. What we're doing is the antithesis, the exact opposite of what he and his officers are doing in the neighborhood, because they're trying to suppress people, beat them down, and enforce the conditions that this capitalist imperialist system brings down on them. And we're bringing to this neighborhood the message that things don't have to be this way. People don't have to suffer this in silence. They should stand up and resist, and they should get connected with an actual revolution to end this horror and all the other horrors. And we're introducing them to the leadership we have for this revolution in Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party. We're getting out copies of Basics. We're showing them clips of video of Avakian speaking in VA through the years. And we're even showing excerpts from the film Revolution Nothing Less. We're starting that tonight in that neighborhood. And people need to follow this. They need to follow the website revcom.us because we're regularly updating things there. And if you go there right now, you not only can see the written reports, but we've got a couple of videos from that rally, one of excerpts from my speech at it, but also the confrontation between me and the district commander over us tearing down the good work that his pigs are doing. I basically laid out to him that you guys are the descendants of the slave chasers and the patrollers that the slave masters used. And he got quite hot under the collar around that. You know, but people really need to watch this. And it's not just a thing of just for your edification, just so you're up on what's happening. People need to weigh in and join this battle. And in addition to following revcom.us, people should follow the Revolution Club Chicago on Twitter. And that's at Rev Club Shy, R-E-V-C-L-U-B-C-H-I is their Twitter handle. And follow me on Twitter, too. That's at Carl_Dix. And the reason for that is that there are times when we're issuing calls for people to contact the Chicago Police Department over the suppression that they're bringing down, to contact the courts over cases that they're throwing up on people, because everybody needs to be a part of this fight. This isn't just something for people in Chicago. Because there's a whole lot at stake here, and I know I'm running on here, but let me get this in. It really comes down to Chicago is known nationwide as the place where black and brown people kill each other. Well, we're trying to bring a different message out of Chicago. We're trying to bring out of Chicago that this is a city where people, black and brown people, but not just black and brown people, all kinds of people are getting out of fighting and killing each other and getting out of standing aside from it and tisking but not doing anything in relation to it, and getting organized into an actual revolution to get rid of the system that's enforcing the conditions to lead to this. And this is very important because, look, I'm old enough to go back to the 1960s, where when the Black Panther Party stood up against the police terror that was being brought down on them, it electrified and inspired Black people across the country, but all kinds of people across the country. And more than just inspiring us to stand up against police terror, it brought a lot of us into the revolution. It showed us that things didn't have to be this way, and that there was another way that things could be, and that revolution was the way to go to that. And that happening today with the Revolution Club and the leadership of Bob Avakian and his new vision and synthesis of revolution and communism, and the vision of a totally different and far better way the world could be, that getting out there can be something that resonates for people all across the country and, frankly, could have its impact even worldwide. So it's really important that people get involved in this, that people take this up, that people spread the word on it, and again, go to revcom.us to be in position to do that, and that people donate to the Revolution Summer Project to help make all this happen.
All right, Carl, I have one question for you. That's all we're going to be able to squeeze in, and it's an important one. Oh. You and I were talking last night a little bit, and you mentioned to me that there's a great importance to what happens in Chicago this summer for the people, for the other side. I mean, the other side has actually declared a sort of unofficial declaration of martial law against the people, and you've got this situation you talk about coming in and saying, you know, you stop the killing, not killing each other, and standing up against the oppression and the oppressors. You mentioned to me last night that there's this great importance nationally and internationally attached to what's happening here. Let's talk about that.
Okay, 3 minutes. Let me just go back to what I was saying in terms of for the authorities, for the capitalist imperialist system and those that enforce it, they've got no future for the people on the bottom of this society, especially the Black and brown people on the bottom of this society. And having them caught up in fighting and killing each other makes it more possible to hold them down. And this is why I've been talking about this slow genocide that this system is bringing down on Black people, and one that, frankly, there are signs of it being escalated, especially with the fascist Trump-Pence regime being in power. It's talk about sending the feds here into Chicago, which they have actually already started to do. Their meetings with the police union, the FOP, Federation of Police, here in Chicago, and their talk about taking the gloves off the police, and this is a police department which has been documented to be carrying out brutality and torture against people. This is their program for the future, and what needs to be brought forward and what we're fighting to bring forward in opposition to that is people standing up, people resisting, and people being connected with an actual revolution, a revolution that aims to get rid of the system, that has the leadership in Bob Avakian to do that, has a strategy that he's led in developing, and has a vision of the kind of world that could be brought into being through revolution that's concentrated in the Constitution for a new socialist republic in North America that Bob Avakian authored. So all of this
15 seconds, Carl.
Is being fought over here and brought forward. And people can get more depth on this by going to that website, revcom.us.
All right, Carl Dix, thank you very much. And we're going to keep this up as a regular feature of the show. Every other week we'll probably have you back, unless there's something that really erupts, and we'll have you back every week. But definitely do that, all right? I really look forward to talking to you, and it's a really important thing that's being done there, and I think people here and all over the world need to follow this, okay?
Okay, and thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Sure, Carl. Right, talk bye. To you later, man. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back.
Light the torches and wake up the king. The smoke you've ignored is a flame you can't contain. We circle the walls and claw at the dirt. We growl from our guts and howl until it hurts.
I recently saw a film called Birthright, A War Story, and it's a feature-length documentary that examines how women are being jailed, physically violated, and even put at risk of dying as a radical movement tightens its grip across America. The film tells the story of women who have become collateral damage in an aggressive campaign to take control of actually, quite frankly, all of women's life and their very existence, their very being. And here to talk with us about this film, her film, is Sivia Tamarkin. And Sivia's film is, as I said, Birthright, a War Story. Sivia, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sure. Let's jump into this. What compelled you to make this film? This is a different film than the category of films you're actually known for, right?
Well, I've always been interested in criminal justice issues, social justice issues. I covered wrongful convictions. I covered child abuse cases, child trafficking cases. So in terms of individual rights and abuses, it is not that different from the types of things I have covered. But what compelled me to do this was the Hobby Lobby decision in June of 2014, when the Supreme Court ruled that an individual employer could deny access to contraceptive coverage on employee health care insurance because of the owner's personal religious beliefs. That decision shocked me. I'm a 60s person. I was one of the hundreds of thousands of women who took to the streets in the late 60s, early 70s, to make sure that we had our privacy rights protected, and was elated with the passage of Roe v. Wade. So like so many other people, I had assumed that this was a given right and that it was no longer really an issue that had to be of primary concern. When I saw that contraception had suddenly become a type of, quote, abortifacient, as the opponents call it, that contraception was being aligned with abortion, I was just dumbfounded. I could not understand how this happened. I could not understand this encroachment on women's privacy, bodily autonomy. And so I set out to understand how we had reached the point of such erosion of individual rights. That became the catalyst.
Now, the thing is that, yes, there's the erosion of individual rights, but there's a very particular focus in this. You know, in particular, it's women. When you look at this and the assault on women, which has really struck me throughout the whole film, it's like you're watching all of these women and all of their experiences and what they're talking about. And it has you enraged and it has you, you know, teared up. But coming out of it, you come out of it with a fairly deep and pressing understanding of there's something really wrong here. And I wanted to ask you about this because the title of your film isn't just Birthright. It's actually the second half, too, A War Story. Let's talk about that.
I think that from the moment the Roe v. Wade decision came down, there was a declaration of war on the part of the opposition. And there has been for the past 40 plus years an insidious erosion of all these rights. And it has been a battle strategy. Both sides will call it a war. And the decision has been embattled from the onset, and very cleverly, very strategically, the opposition began to map out a plan. They infiltrated the Republican Party. They formed alliances. They formed agreements. I mean, in many cases, strange bedfellow pacts, if you will. I mean, it is quite unusual to see the religious right supporting Donald Trump. But nevertheless, they strategized toward their objective. They groomed a youth corps of foot soldiers. From the onset, there was a plan of erosion, of invasion. There's no question that it is a war. It has been a declaration of war, and they are convinced that they are certainly winning.
You know, one of the things that was really grabbed me was actually that the process of making the film also illustrated exactly that point, that it is a war story, that there are elements of this war against women in there, very much so. What did it take to actually be able to make this film?
It was very difficult to get people to go on camera because there has been such fear. On the part of women, there has been such a stigmatization of abortion, even in many cases of the use of contraception, depending upon their religious community. But what is very clear is starting in the late 70s, going through the 80s, this has been a domestic terrorist attack. We've had physician providers murdered. We've had clinic bombings. We have had death threats. They're continuing. In fact, I had read a recent report that since Donald Trump took office 7 months ago, that the attacks and threats have increased exponentially. So it was very difficult to get women who have been victimized on camera because they're embarrassed and afraid of repercussions within their community. But more significantly, it was difficult to get providers and clinicians to go on camera because they were afraid of being ostracized. They were afraid that it might harm their professional affiliations with hospitals, professional affiliations within their community. So that was very, very much a challenge because so many people feel beleaguered.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said also that you began the film as a project that was looking into women's rights, and you were referring to that earlier on as we spoke, but that you also found out through the course of digging into this that far more was involved and at stake in this battle than you originally thought. Let's talk about what you found out.
What was so surprising is that, as we call it, the collateral damage, the fallout from this war on abortion, that the same rhetoric, the same ideology, the same principles of protecting the unborn and giving the fetus constitutional rights has created a ripple effect that ensnares women who may, in fact, be on the opposite side of the argument. What you are finding is in an effort to establish the personhood and the constitutional protections of the fetus, that laws designed to protect children are being misapplied and being turned against pregnant women. So pregnant women, for example, are being criminalized for behavior that people in the state, in the county, in municipal authorities may deem inappropriate. We're finding that with the rise of Catholic health care and the takeover of insolvent private and public community hospitals, 1 in 6 beds in acute care facilities is now owned or affiliated with Catholic health care. The problem there is that the medical treatment is not evidence-based, but it is based upon religious doctrine. So there are situations where a physician is on the phone with a bishop. We are finding that the ripple effect continues into the birthing process as well. So women who are carrying a much-wanted pregnancy and want to give birth in a manner that they choose, whether it is natural childbirth or home birth, find themselves being controlled by the courts, because doctors, hospitals have gone to court to claim guardianship of the unborn fetus and force a woman to have a cesarean section or force a woman to be on bed rest. There's a case I recently heard about, which unfortunately we don't have in the film because it just surfaced in the courts, but it's a woman in Washington who had a stillbirth. And she's now being charged criminally because they are claiming she did not get the proper prenatal care.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with filmmaker Sibia Tamarkin about her brand new film, Birthright, A War Story. When you go through this, I can't help but think, you know, there's a couple places in the film and in some of the stuff that you've written about it. At one point, there was a comparison of abortion rights, a battle for abortion rights to the Civil War. And that what I kept thinking about, and there's also references to what's become a very popular reference these days, given the television show, but also even before that when the book was out there and people who had any conscience were actually trying to devour this book and spread it around, The Handmaid's Tale. There's really something that jumps out at people if you're at all sentient and at all understand what the hell is going on. This idea of women having no control of their body equals slavery. This is a very heavy thing to understand because it really is actually grabbing the humanity of women and saying, to hell with it. You are not second-rate citizen. You are not human. To me, it's just unfathomable and unacceptable.
Well, the goal here was to present the issue as a human rights violation here. I think that over the past 4 decades or so, everyone has been so fixated on the singular medical procedure of abortion. and it has obscured the larger issue that what we are talking about is a woman's right to bodily integrity, bodily autonomy, and human rights. If these kind of violations were being headlined as occurring in other countries, there would be outrage. We talk about female genital mutilation, we talk about Sharia law, we talk about all the restrictions on women, and yet American women have to realize that they are in dangerous territory here, that it is happening here. And it's interesting, the comparison to Handmaid's Tale, it was just coincidental, of course, that the timing of the series came out right before our film release. But I had always viewed this as The Handmaid's Tale. I read the book back in the 80s when it first came out. Mm-hmm. In fact, we had considered putting a clip from, I think it's 1995 or so, movie with Natasha Richardson in the film, but the cost was prohibitive to use the clip. So I had always seen this. The bottom line, of course, is that you have a radical religious movement that is attempting to blur the line between church and state and govern as a theocracy and impose religious doctrine. You have a government that would like to ban contraception and ban abortion. So de facto, the government is forcing women to become breeders, just as the premise in this dystopian novel, The Handmaid's Tale.
That point, exactly that point. The woman does not have control over her body. She has been, in fact, reduced to a slave de facto. I mean, it's sort of, this is what's happening.
And, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Those who are opposed to abortion will point out, and, you know, their criticism of this is that, of course, women are leading the anti-abortion movement. The head of the National Right to Life, Carol Tobias, and the founder and former executive director of Americans United for Life, Charmaine Yost, who now happens to be a deputy under Tom Price in the Department of Health and Human Services. So that shows you how the infiltration and co-op of the government agencies is taking place. But they'll say that women are leading the movement and claim it is certainly not the enslavement of women. They claim that the only harm against women is against female fetuses.
And actually, that's the point, even when you talk about this fetus first policy. Ironically, the fetus has full standing as a human being while the woman is denigrated down to less than human. And it's just, it's so enraging. One of the things when you point out that I think it's important for people to understand is in the film, you actually show a series of women who have gone through horrendous things that actually illustrate what happens when you have no control over your own body in relation to health and that kind of health care that you need and all this. You have women who have been sent to jail, who have been put up on charges, who have, I mean, just horrendous things happening to these women. And it's all being done, to a certain extent, under a blanket that keeps it silent and unseen.
Yes, and it is all part of a strategy to create a body of jurisprudence, enough laws to establish the personhood of the fetus. Because there are some factions within the anti-abortion movement that say, we don't have to worry about overturning Roe v. Wade. If we can establish the personhood of the fetus, then any harm that comes to that fetus can be prosecuted under criminal statutes, like homicide. So it certainly does put the autonomy and bodily integrity of a woman in second place. It's a very simple premise. You cannot have two constitutionally protected beings within one body. And therefore, according to the ideology of the opposition movement here, women are the ones who are going to suffer. What's so interesting is there is no other instance in the law, certainly, in which an individual can be forced to undergo medical procedures, can be forced to have any external influence on their bodily organs. There's case law where you cannot be forced to become a donor. You cannot be forced to have an arm or leg or any part of your body surgically removed. But yet, all of this case law seems to disappear when we're talking about a woman's reproductive organs.
Yeah, absolutely. Which again comes down to, it's an establishment of, or it's an assertion that a woman's body is not hers. It's not her body, and that the fetus actually,
exactly.
Yeah, and that the fetus is actually more important than the woman's body, and not a part of the woman's body, but something that's actually existent with a sort of blessed being of its own or something. It's just, when you put together all of the medieval religious beliefs and everything else that go on in here with the standards since for so long, the oppression of women, it really sharpens things up to a, just a red-hot degree. And I wanted to ask you one last question around this. You've talked a lot about, as you go through the film, there's also a point where you've talked about that when you come out of this, standing before you, and there's so much more to talk about, I should say, there's like people will see this film, they'll see young women talking about basically, actually shockingly, how little they actually know about the fight for abortion rights and why that's important and what it actually even means. But you're in this kind of society where women's bodies are being stolen from them and the oppression is intense and immense. And there's very little knowledge broadly among younger people, young women who may know that there's abortions, but don't have any idea about any of the fight to get there or what's happened. And there's also, though, you talk about in the midst of all that, there's a real need to and a beginning to do this, but the fight for not just the right to an abortion, but for reproductive justice. Let's talk about that.
Absolutely. I think that we're talking about generations here who have had the benefit of the legality of abortion and full access to contraception. And so when one has a right, you do not assume it's going to be taken away, particularly when it's a constitutionally validated and codified right by the courts. So in fairness to many of the younger women, they assumed this was a given. It was something that they were entitled to, could access, and the vigilance was dropped. People were caught off guard. And it slowly, slowly was nibbled away. It's not taught in school very infrequently, unless you're taking a particular women's studies course. Sex education is now being controlled by the radical religious right, so that in many school districts, abstinence only is taught. So there was no reason for a younger generation to see that they were losing this right. And when the Republicans mobilized, particularly in a backlash against Barack Obama in 2010, it took everybody by storm, and the religious right has secured their footholds in these state legislatures. Now, the problem is that I think what we've learned is that words like choice have minimized the impact of what we're talking about. You know, choice has become a cavalier word, a word that has a rather cavalier connotation. We all make choices every day in the course of our lives. The issue is certainly one of reproductive justice. And reproductive justice precludes the states and the legislatures from determining whether or not, when, how you will give birth, but it's far more encompassing. It involves a woman's right to bodily autonomy. It involves a woman's medical decision-making. It involves her own right to determine whether she will have children. But beyond that, very much the right to economic accessibility and mobility, the right to raise the children that she has in a safe environment. So reproductive justice goes far beyond just the issue of abortion. It makes reproductive rights a human right, and that's what we had hoped this film will show. We're not talking about a singular medical procedure, but women's human rights that are being assaulted in the United States of America.
Absolutely, and very important. The right of women to actually live as fully functioning human beings. And Sivia, I want to thank you very much for the film and for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Smash the system.
Let's go down to the riot. It's summertime, and now's the time to smash the system.
Smash the system.
Smash the system.
All right, welcome back. That's Smash the System from Luke Haynes. And I just want to let people know, as always, you can find the links to everything Carl Dix was talking about on my Facebook page. All right, we are going to now listen to some sound that I got from the demonstration, the July 15th demonstration in different places. One is in L.A. in Los Angeles, and it's a young person reading the statement about the demonstrations. And the other, the first, is a piece from Reverend Smith in the San Francisco demonstration. All right, so we're going to take a listen to that, and we'll be back when this is over.
Next, I want to introduce the senior pastor at Allen Temple Baptist Church, Reverend J. Alfred Smith. Give it up.
It is a privilege to be here with you on this very important day. And I have been deeply moved and challenged by all of the speakers who have presented. And I want you to know that they have said many of the things that I wanted to share. And so for me to go any further would be to be redundant. And indeed, I am speaking, I'm preaching to the choir. I'm preaching to the choir. The other day I was talking with my friends, Brother DeAndre and Brother Scott, and one of the things that we all agreed with as we reflected on what's going on in this country is that folk seem to be very conversant about the atrocities that are multiplying daily, but they have not, in many cases, and particularly with the news media, put a face on this. There's been an elephant in the room, and nobody wants to name the elephant. Well, today, that elephant has been named several times. But in case any of us are slow in seeing the picture, the face of the elephant in the room, all we have to do is connect the many dots that have been identified which describe this elephant. We've heard a mention of the fact that this is an autocratic, authoritarian regime that rules by fear. That's a dot. We have identified that this is a racist, white supremacist regime that promotes state-sponsored persecution, discrimination, and violence against people of color, particularly black lives, brown people, our native people. It has perpetrated this against immigrants, against Muslims, against LGBTQI sisters and brothers, against women. That just about includes all of us. Against the poor, against those who are vulnerable, this regime has assaulted science, has raped the environment. This regime is turning over sectors of government that are supposed to be led by civilians and turned them over to military generals. These are all dots. And I want you to know that many other dots were identified so vividly that if we would just connect the dots, we would see a three-dimensional panoramic view of the ugly face of fascism. Scott asked me, he said, well, Jay, are you going to use the F word? And y'all, I'm pretty free, but when he said the F word, I was taken aback. I said, no, I don't think I'm going to use that word, though some other speakers have used it today. But he wasn't talking about that F word. He was talking about the F word called fascism. And my sisters and brothers, we're going to have to confront fascism. We're going to have to fight fascism. We're going to have to refuse fascism. We're going to have to resist fascism. And so I come to you. It's not strange that an African-American clergyman, a clergy person, would come on a day like this. It's a part of the tradition that we have for resistance, going all the way back to Denmark Vesey and Nat Turner and Sojourner Truth and the great Harriet Tubman. It's a part of the tradition that I respect, and I can see the ancestors from that great cloud of witnesses challenging people of faith not to get weary, not to sit down when action is demanded. I can hear Martin King calling us forward. I can hear El Haj Malik Shabazz, Malcolm X, calling us forth. So as a clergyman, I have no other recourse but to be here. I can hear Martin Niemöller, that German Lutheran pastor who spoke forth words that resonate and echo in my spirit, words that bring me into self-introspection. He noted that during the 1930s, he and the Protestant churches of Germany preferred to remain silent. He said, clearly we are not innocent. And I wonder again and again what would have happened if in 1933 or 1934, 14,000 Protestant pastors and all the Protestant communities in Germany would have defended the truth to their death. If we had said, it is not right that Hermann Göring just puts 10,000 communists in concentration camps to die, I can imagine that perhaps 30,000 or 40,000 Protestant Christians would have died. But I can also imagine that we would have saved 30 or 40 million people, because that's what the silence cost us. Martin King has said that the ultimate measure of a person is not where one stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where one stands at times of challenge and controversy. So I want to close by saying we can't afford to stand on the sidelines. Don't fall asleep. Stay woke. Don't acquiesce to evil. Resist. Resist white supremacy. Resist the outright. Resist Trump Pence. Resist fascism. Resist the fascist assault on truth as it creates a culture of lies and so-called alternative facts. Resist fascism as it attacks science
and rapes the environment. Resist sexism. Resist oppression and demonization of our LGBTQI community. Resist oppression and mistreatment against our Latino sisters and brothers, and our Muslim sisters and brothers, and all immigrants who live in the shadows. Resist until the demonic triplets of militarism, racism, and poverty have been eradicated. Resist, I tell you, resist until justice rolls down like rivers and righteousness like a mighty stream. Resist until that prophetic vision of justice is fulfilled, where every valley shall be exalted and every mountain made low and the crooked places made straight and the rough places smooth. Resist, resist even beyond Trump and fence. Resist until the day comes when nation will not rise up against nation, nor study war no more. Resist. Don't be silent. Don't be still. Resist, resist, resist.
Like she said, I'm Tala. I'm a UCLA student and I'm with the Revolution Club here in Los Angeles. I have a message to the brave fighters and dreamers of July 15th from the Revolutionary Communist Party, USA. On behalf of the Revolutionary Communist Party, I want to salute everyone who came out here today. Everyone who stood up to the intimidation and threats. Everyone who fought through the defeatism that's out there. Everyone who has responded to the relentless implantation of fascism with the most eloquent of answers, no. We especially salute all those who over these past months have birthed the absolutely essential organization that is Refuse Fascism. And especially those of you who were living your lives and then answered the call posed by events and have thrown so much into this. This vehicle of Refuse Fascism, it's precious. And the time is now for this to get far bigger, far stronger, and far more all-embracing so that we can drive out this regime before it's too late. Continue not just to resist, but go further in this battle. This is life and death for tens of millions of people, and possibly even more. Let's struggle in the days to come to draw every lesson we can from today and everything that has led up to this. Let's interrogate what we've done, and then let's do better, because the stakes are way too high to do anything less. Today can be and must be not just a good thing to do, but a point of departure for a whole new level of struggle. But we want to ask you to go further, too. Listen to this invitation from the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party USA, Bob Avakian, or BA. It's on page 3 of this month's issue of Revolution newspaper. Let's go on a crucial journey together, full of unity against oppression, and lively struggle about the source of the problem and the solution. Pursue your own convictions that the outrages that move you are intolerable to their logical conclusion, and be determined not to stop until these outrages have been eliminated. And if this, as well as learning about other outrages and ideas about how all this fits together and flows from a common source, if this leads in the direction of seeing not only the need for bold and determined resistance, but also the need for revolution and ultimately communism. then don't turn away because it moves you beyond your comfort zone. Challenges what have been your cherished beliefs or because of slanders and prejudices. Instead, actively seek to learn more about this revolution and its final goal of communism, and to determine whether it is in fact the necessary and possible solution, and then act accordingly. There's a way to take up that invitation. Get into BA, read the New Communism, which puts forth just what it says, a new communism, a way to scientifically understand and transform the world.
Communism.
To make revolution and to keep that revolution on the road to real emancipation. Get into the Constitution for the new socialist republic in North America. It lays out a framework and a blueprint for the radically new and far better society that really is possible through that revolution. Pick up and carry with you Basics, the handbook for revolutionary fighters. Here's a chance and a challenge to learn where this madness we're fighting today comes from, how it flows out of a system of capitalism imperialism, to learn why we need a revolution and why that revolution can and must overthrow this system, to learn how such a revolution could actually come about, and to learn your role in all of this. Go to www.revcom.us every day and learn how events fit together and what they mean for revolution. Join the Revolution Club, where you can not only learn about this, but be part of fighting the power as part of making revolution, where you can change the world and change yourself in the process, with people just like you and with people very different from you, in the spirit of struggle and questioning and courage and love. Let's go forward together. Let's drive out this regime, and let's move on then to build a whole new world where the hellish nightmares of today really are no more, and humanity can truly flourish.
Now remember, folks, this was sound taken from the July 15th march, and that was Reverend Alfred J. Smith, Jr. from San Francisco. The other speaker was Tala from the Revolution Club in Los Angeles. If you want to get in touch with Refuse Fascism, you can go to refusefascism.org. We're going to go out now with a piece from Randy Newman called Political Science.
I don't know why we may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? No, they're spiteful and they're hateful. They don't respect us, so let's surprise them. We'll drop the big one and pulverize them. Asia's crowded, Europe's too old, Africa's far too hot and